Welcome back to another episode of Bed Talks. We are super excited for our next guest. His name is Morgan England. He has such an interesting background. I'm going to let him tell you more, but just a little bit about him. He's been from the Hollywood glitz of life. I think you were on a soap opera, Guiding Light, if I'm not mistaken. So he's been an actor. He's also been a firefighter. So that's a whole nother story we'll get into. And he also makes music, really cool music, connecting music. And so I'm really curious to hear and learn more. And I know Kay is too, of your journey, but welcome to the show, Morgan.
Thank you. So glad to be here. Yes. Long time coming. Yeah,
I know. So Morgan England, we've been trying to connect for like a while. We both have had busy schedules and other personal things that have happened, but we're just so happy to have you here today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, born in 1963 in Los Angeles. My mother was a famous actress. So she was gone a lot of the time. Learned how to take care of myself at a young age. And I was, I got in a lot of trouble. I got kicked out of five junior high schools and got arrested several times. And then I found football and it changed my life. It was everything I needed, the discipline, the father figure, the brothers, that feeling like you'd die for each other. You know, that connection was just something I sought for the rest of my life after that. Because my mother was an actress, it never occurred to me to be an actor. I mean, I was diametrically opposed to it because I didn't want to be, her son, the actor, you know, and have that stigma. So I started playing football, loved it. And then I ruptured my kidney and they said, you can't play football anymore, but I wasn't ready to give it up. So I played two more years in junior college. Did really well. I was 168 pounds starting right guard. It's a long story. I went for defensive back, but I wasn't going to play. So I got the coach to let me try out one day and he couldn't believe it. And damn it, there's no such thing as 168 pound guard.
Thank you, because I'm sure you saw the expression on my face. I was like, hold on, you mentioned 168 right guard. I didn't know if you were talking about Pop Warner football.
No, this was, and we went 10-1. This was a tough conference. I mean, we were a really good team. And I mean, I got away with it with the quickness. We ran over a lot of the defense was a 3-2. Okay. I had a linebacker over me most of the time. If I didn't, you know, the safety or the other guy would help me out for a running play. But we ran a lot of sweeps, a lot of passes. So on those sweeps, I mean, it was fun. I loved to hit. I went to Colorado. My dream was to play in the snow. And I went to Boulder, Colorado, got accepted there. And they found out about my kidney and they did tests for about 3 weeks, all these specialists and all this testing. And they finally they were like, there's no way we can let you play because I have what's called a horseshoe kidney. So my kidneys, which are separate, supposed to be separate, are connected across the front of my abdomen. So I got hit in the front where there shouldn't be anything, you know, you bleed from. So internal bleeding and all that. I was in the ICU for 3 weeks. But when I got to Colorado and that ended, you know, at that level, that's kind of who you are. That's your identity. It's what you do. And that was a real blow to try to figure out. I didn't go there to study English. I went there to play football. So I was at loss. And then a friend of mine said, hey, let's take this acting class. I'm like, okay, whatever, sure. And I was terrible the first time. And then another woman got up on stage and she decorated the whole stage and made this whole room, this world. And by the time she was done setting it up, we were sitting on the edge of our seats, like, what's going to happen next? And she had us in that world she created. And I saw that she was on the same exact stage that I was on. And what she did and what I did were completely different things. So that's when I was like, okay, yeah, I want to try this. And I just got into it. I was good at it. And felt like this is my calling. So I auditioned for a school in New York, Circle in the Square Theater School. I got in and it's kind of like Juilliard. So it's classical training, you know, drama, singing, voice, stage combat, the whole thing. But during the middle of that, I got offered a part in, well, I auditioned for and got a part in the play Picnic at the Amundsen Theater in Los Angeles, which is kind of like the Broadway of Los Angeles, you know, as opposed to New York. And while I was doing that, my brother overdosed and died alone in New York. And another crushing blow. I was bartending and drinking, riding my motorcycle home, drunk as a skunk at night. I don't know how I lived through it, but you know, I cleaned myself up and I decided I want to get back into acting. Got back together with my girlfriend from college, and she was on the East Coast. And I decided, yeah, I want to be an actor. I'm going to go back to New York. If you want to go to Hollywood, it's for fame and fortune. If you want to go to New York, it's because you care about the art and what you're
hardcore. Because so number one, I want to just pause you for a second. Like, you shared so much that I have so many questions. He knows me, my mind's going. But it's really impressive that you were okay. A couple of things. I saw a couple of things. It felt like you were trying to find your identity a lot. Different things, whether it was sports and acting. And then I want to give credit, number one, to soap opera actors and actresses, because I always feel like you have to be so disciplined to the art, because sometimes you guys are carrying out very dramatic situations and you make them believable. So I've always felt like soap opera actors and actresses don't always get their due of just the work, but just the fact that you also had the theater part. And I think when we look at actors and actresses, we don't realize how multidimensional you are, or multifaceted. People kind of bucket people and then they're like, wait, they're on Broadway? Wait, they could dance, they could sing. And I'm never surprised, because I feel like to be an artist, it takes so much creativity that oftentimes is not as appreciated as it should be, and so much work, because you're really taking us into another world and you're making us believe something is true that's not true. And that takes a lot of like creativity and method acting. I mean, to bring the audience along that journey and really make us feel that character. So I just wanted to do shout out for all these different facets of yourself. But going back to your identity, I can relate to this, not on the same level as you can, of course, but my dad was very popular within his religion. And a lot of people leaned into him. Great dad, but just when you have a parent like that, that so many people are reaching to and looking to for help, a lot of times you could feel left behind, because that time is always being extended outside versus inside. And sometimes the parent doesn't have that realization that's happening until many, you know, years pass, and the kids tell them that because they're doing something they love. It's something that's purposeful for them. It's meaningful. It's something that they, you know, people derive value for the wisdom or the art that they're giving them. So it sounds like you and your brother may have struggled with some of this, because I heard a couple of things you said, like, I grew up, I had to grow myself up, I had to figure some things out, I was looking for connection. I found that in sports. And even though you had this kidney thing going on and you were 168 pounds, I understand football, I was like, that's really small, I know that for that position, you were still willing to commit yourself to this because it felt like you felt part of something. So can you talk a little bit more about like how you got yourself through the point where you finally said, you know what, let me get myself together? Because you mentioned like being arrested several times, making bad decisions, and figuring it out. And it sounds like you've been on quite a journey, because I mean, you did the Hollywood thing, you've done, you know, the acting thing in the theaters you talked about, you've done a firefighter thing, right? And now you're doing music. So I'm curious if you could walk us through some of those, you know, pieces of your journey of how you got there.
Got where, like,
to where you are, I guess, like you said that there was a lot of identity, and then there was you figuring out things, and you realized, I'm really good at acting, and you said, I'm going to really commit to this. So like, let's talk about that phase.
Okay.
I'm curious to see how you move to the next phases.
Right. Sure. Well, so when I decided to move back to New York, came back, I had $200 in my pocket, sleeping on rooftops for 3 weeks, mm-hmm. and loving it. One of the things I did before I came back to New York, I thought, well, how might I be sabotaging myself in my own career? My father was, I don't know, anyway. And I said, well, I don't audition for soap operas. It's not something I wanted to do, at all. And so I never auditioned for them. So I said, well, let me just open it up and audition for them as well. So 7 months to the day, I got that job. And it was both a blessing and a curse, because it was steady employment. It was good work. And also about my show in particular, it was Guiding Light, and it was all New York actor. I mean, some incredible actors on that show that I did. And I was doing theater at night. I was either performing or in rehearsals after, you know, working 12 hours at this soap opera. So, you know, I got married. It was a bad idea. I knew it. We weren't going to work from the beginning. And I just was committed, and I didn't want to be one of those people that said, oh, we're calling it off. So I stuck with it, but it, ultimately failed. We had two kids, and after I'd done the soap opera for like 5.5 years, I realized our marriage was failing, and I didn't want to raise them in New York. I wanted to raise them back in California. And so we moved back to California, marriage fell apart. And then I was actually recording an album in Nashville, and I was about to go on the road, and I got a call from my wife. And in that phone call, I realized a couple things: that our marriage was over, and that me falling.
How many years? I'm sorry to interrupt, but how many years were you all married before the
7 or 8.
Okay.
Yeah. 7 or 8 years, or maybe 9. 9 years, I think. So I realized my mother was never there. The light switches never worked. I never knew who was coming in and out, and it was just a chaos. And so it was really important to me to have a home for my kids, you know, that was love and that I was there and a father. And so I said, I need to do something that they can be proud of, that I can be proud of, and that I'll put a roof over our heads and give us security. And I thought long and hard about everything. And finally I thought, you know, when I was a kid, the idea of search and rescue, people sacrificing themselves for the welfare of others, like what higher calling is that? Is there than that? So I became an EMT, and then I decided to become a paramedic and really go full steam with it. And then once I became a paramedic, I worked for about 3 years in the field, 911. And, you know, the money and the real longevity is in the fire department. That's where you go. So I ended up applying and getting into the fire department here in Los Angeles, and did almost 14 years with them, and decided it was time for me to leave, and I left.
And it sounds like it was an adrenaline rush. And you correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, here it is, a guy who went from playing football, loving football, even with if I remember what you said correctly, a severed kidney. It sounds like that once you were forced to stop playing football, and you decided, you know, maybe to dally in a little bit of acting and so forth, this firefighter call came into play. So me being an athlete myself, I just wondered, when you decided to take on this new role, this new career, was there an adrenaline rush that stemmed probably from you playing football and just wanting the feel of that brotherhood, feeling of the rescue, the conquer, the win? Do you think that played a part in you making that transition or being drawn to that particular career?
The brotherhood is huge. That's what we all think that we're joining.
Because that never leaves.
Well, that idea of that is, you know, it was something that was really important to me that I wanted to have in my life. I didn't experience that in the fire department. I experienced
it. Oh, you did not?
No, not at all.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I had friends and stuff, but this, that was the biggest lie that we all believed. And and once you're there and you see what you're facing for 30 years, I think it really messes people up. It messed me up, and I've lost friends, firefighters that have taken their own lives, you know. And I don't think it's because they went on a scary call or something. I think it's because they thought that they were entering this brotherhood or this family, you know, I mean, women and men, but, you know, it's hard. It should be hard. You go through the academy, you need to run the gauntlet, and you need to pass the tests. You need to have the basic ability to do the job. And then you're tested for a year, trained and tested for a year out in the field as a rookie firefighter. If you make it through all that, then you get your badge, your shield. And at that point you'd think, okay, I've made it, you know, I've proven myself. I mean, obviously you have to prove yourself in other ways, But I felt like a rookie the whole time I was at the fire department, pretty much. Even though I was, you know, running calls on scene, I was a paramedic, so I'm the highest medical authority on most of the medical or trauma calls that we go on. But that was really difficult for me and heartbreaking. And I know that there are a lot of people struggling there now, especially after COVID and the way that a lot of the fire departments treat their members. It's just,
wow.
It's a tough job, but to not really have any support from your department is way tougher, you know, to feel that you're alone and you're all hanging out there in the wind.
I'm gonna be honest with you, Morgan. I did not expect that response, but it's good to know there is another side of being in that so-called, you know, brotherhood, which I really was trying to equate playing, you know.
Yeah, of course, football
and getting back, right?
Finally, I'm gonna.
Right. So I'm curious. Man, you said you were a firefighter for 14, 15 years. So what kept you in it that long when this type of dispersion was taking place where it did not feel like a brotherhood? You felt like a rookie. If I'm not mistaken, was it the whole duration of you being a firefighter or just for a short period of time?
There are, you know, obviously different stations have different vibes. Mm-hmm. A lot of it has to do with the captain, you know, what vibe he sets, who he approves of and who he doesn't. Then that cues the crew and stuff. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, very large departments, I think, are more prone to this type of culture. I think smaller departments, you can't get away with it. I told my cousin is a firefighter at a small department. He's a captain now. And telling him some of this stuff. And he was like, I've heard these stories. But had I known what you were going through, I would have said, come here, man. We can't wait to have you. You know, firefighter from a big department, you know, that's I'm running 15, 18 calls a day sometimes, you know. So I think there are different cultures, but I've really found overall in the first responder culture, it's you're hard on each other, and where I think the idea of the macho thing, yeah, you need to suck it up. You need to be able to suck it up and get through and do things like that. That's important. But I think there's a whole part that's being left out. You know, it's all, I don't have any feelings. You know, I'm tough. No, you're not. You're a human being, you know, and either one way or another, whether you internalize everything and it becomes cancer or disease, or you take a shotgun to your head, or you live in depression, isolation, and misery. I think, and I'm not really talking about coming back from a call and saying, oh, that was so hard or something like that. It's just, it's being able to communicate without fear of, okay, so let's say you're on a fire, you're on a roof. We're on a roof, fire's blowing out underneath us. We go in, we're dead instantly. So it really matters that your relationship to your team and knowing what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and knowing that they got your back and them knowing that you got their back. I mean, this is life and death type stuff. So it's really important. And, you know, we do a lot of training and stuff, but I think there's a way to have emotion, to be able to talk and stuff. And honestly, I believe it takes more strength and courage to do that than to just say, I'm tough. I leave my feelings on the off ramp when I come to work.
As a man, especially as a man.
Yeah. But yeah. Honestly, I think it's the more cowardly way. I think it's much tougher to, for instance, we're all, let's say after dinner, we're wiping down the rigs, all the firefighters, and we gather in a circle. And I don't know how it came up, but, you know, one guy was saying, well, I leave my feelings at home when I come to work. There's some call we went on and the guy said, I don't feel anything about that. I leave my feelings at home. Another guy says, I leave them on the off ramp when I get off the freeway. And then it gets around to me and they look at me and I'm like, I feel everything. And they're like, oh God, there he goes again. England, you know, or I'll, point out a full moon. How incredible.
Let's pull one.
So like, you know, we're standing, this is a perfect example, standing on a roof after a fire, you know, we've got it, knocked it down. We're the roof team and the sun hasn't come up yet, but the glow is just starting to, you know, of the new day, and you see this incredible moon up there. And just, there's just incredible moments in that job. And, you know, I'm just very, I think nature, we're human beings. We live in the world. We're not, firefighters doesn't make us, doesn't, you know, separate us from that. And, you know, something like a beautiful full moon, I think it's incredible to take a moment to stop and see it. But by saying that, you know, I open myself up to, you know, being called, you know, it's too feely, too, you know, so.
So do you think, okay, because again, you're really educating the audience on some of the pros and cons of being in any type of brotherhood for that matter. But since we're talking about firefighters, this is the topic of discussion. As men, me and Elizabeth talk from time to time, as men, we do tend to keep a lot of things hoarded in, a lot of things kept in. But when you're in that line of work, and I've been in some intense situations, nothing along the lines of what, you know, firefighters yourself and others have had to do. There have been times where, yeah, you bring it all with you, you take it all with you, and it just wreaks havoc on your psyche, your mind. So what I've seen, and sometimes I've even tried, is to not only suppress it, but to try to numb it to where, okay, this stays at my place of employment, I'm not bringing it home, or vice versa. But what happens then is it tends to bottle up even the more inside. It's not like we're switches. We tend to treat this psyche of ours, this mind of ours, as if it's a switch. And I think to a certain extent you can, but that can be a dangerous thing because you're literally dulling your natural senses to be able to cope and to be able to deal with the rigors of whatever that job implies. So when I heard you say that, you know, when it got around to you, hey, Morgan, what do you think? Well, man, dude, I feel everything. I don't know what you guys are on. Are y'all robots or something? I feel everything. And then it was, you were deemed as, oh, here's the Philly guy. That's the culture that most men have not only grown up in, but then as adult men tend to hold on to. But then a guy like you, and even on occasion myself, yeah, I do. I'll open up about certain things. What do you think the actual line is to, or advantages and disadvantages are to keeping your emotions to yourself, keeping them bottled up, or keeping them at a certain destination, or releasing, feeling them, and talking about them? What do you think the pros and cons are to either one of those?
Well, I think you need to have an outlet, whatever that outlet is. I mean, there were so many times I'd be coming home from work and just listening to music and tears would just be rolling down my face.
Well, I'm trying to see that you had a connection on maybe why you started leaning into the music more too, maybe potentially. Is this part of your journey?
Well, when I was in Nashville and I made that decision, or whenever I made that decision to put the music and the acting away and do this 100%, I said, I'm going to get back to it one day. When I've raised my kids, I'm going to get back to the music. And so I was 54. I'd really lost motivation and any passion I had a few years before that for the fire department, I think. I just didn't know it yet. And as to your question, you don't quit the fire department. Nobody does that. I mean, it wouldn't even occur to me. So it wasn't until my mother, I said, I need to quit this job. Just kind of talking out loud. She's like, well, why don't you then? And I said, well, let me see what that looks like. And anyway, I decided it was time for me to leave. And sorry, I got off the point you were asking, Elizabeth.
No, it's okay. Cause I mean, I could pause you for a second here. There's a couple of things I'm picking up on. It is interesting. I think you are talking about something that's very familiar to a lot of people. I think oftentimes we make sacrifices for our family and our loved ones, and we do things we may not you know, initially a plan to do, we take a diversion, right? And we say, okay, I'll go into this. I'm going to throw my all into it. But deep down inside, we know that thing isn't our thing. Because when it's your thing, you feel it. And I think that's the thing people always ask, how do these people take risk and do these things? I don't think it's a comfortable thing to say, I'm going to step into being a magician. Let's just use something like that. But if David Copperfield obviously was like, this is something I enjoy doing, and he kept doing it. And eventually he was fortunate enough to be successful, but that's not everyone's story. So there's risk, right? And rewards on both sides of this. But I think it's interesting some of the other things you tapped into, just like you were in a situation where you weren't happy, right? And you were trying to push through it because I could see the bigger purpose. I want to be there for my kids. This is something I didn't have. I want my kids to feel loved. I mean, you made that sacrifice to move back to California so you could have that central unit, even though you were going through the marital, you know, issues, right? So there's power in that too. But at the same time, it's interesting to watch human development because people tend to go back eventually to the thing they do love. Mm-hmm. And the thing that does feed them. So I just thought your journey of all those things was pretty interesting. And then just the fact that like being a firefighter, and also a first responder, those are very like high stress jobs, similar to being policemen. But yet these are still areas that we don't always talk about where the mental health of the people doing these jobs is being impacted. You can't go into traumatic situations and not feel anything. And if people say they're not, then there's something going
on
there.
That's why I was asking, I was asking Morgan, you know, what does he believe are the pros and the cons to both sides? Individuals who it's hard for them to cope with these intense situations and they just bottle it up or leave it in a bottle.
Or they're numbing. They're numbing out. Like right. I said, they're doing other.
Express it, you know.
Right. They're numbing out where they're doing other things to distract themselves. And like you said, a firefighter, can you imagine if you come from a family similar to like policemen, right? Where everyone in your family pretty much, or many people in your family were a firefighter or a policeman. And you say, you know what? I can't take this anymore. But you've seen generations of people deal with it, not complain about it or manage it. So there's this lack of education and vulnerability and openness about how to manage through the emotional space, which I'm sure those other generations went through, which impacted probably their family relationships, other relationships, right? That just doesn't get talked about. So I think it actually was very courageous of you to open up these conversations, even though it wasn't received well. You never know who you may have affected or helped to affect, who maybe just didn't feel comfortable saying anything, because even though you're supposed to be in this brotherhood, the brotherhood, even if it exists or doesn't exist, or there's a facade of it, people don't feel comfortable to speak up against.
And that's why, and I'm so glad you said that, because that's the part that I really was commending you in, Morgan, you know, being a man myself and being in those situations where you're taught to not express your feelings and emotions. I put it in the analogy of the classroom, and I've used this analogy quite a few times before with students that I've taught, coached. You'll have a particular assignment, and during that assignment, the instructor is giving the lesson plan and so forth. The instructor asks, does anyone have any questions? 99% of the time, no one raises their hand. It doesn't mean that everyone understands. What it does mean is the majority tends to rule, okay? You have 99% of the students, they don't understand.
I'm that 1%. I'm always the guy that's going to raise
and that's, and some that's fun. Where I was going. That's where I was going, Morgan. I was the guy that, I may have been a little reluctant as well. Like, dog, is everyone else? I'm the only one. No, come on now.
Can't be me.
But then this is what I've found, not only with myself, but even as I would teach students, you may have that one bold soul. Sometimes you'd have to come back around, and I would. I come back around. Guys, girls, please open up. If you have a question, ask it. It's never a dumb question. Never a dumb question. Then all of a sudden you may see kind of this. And whenever I would see just a sleight of hand, that's a musician term, just a sleight of hand, I was like, what's your question, sir? What's your question, ma'am? To where they would be confident enough to ask. But what I would always find, man, most times, it only took that one student, that bold young man, young lady, to raise their hand or just simply to ask the question, to where now others followed suit. So to what Elizabeth was saying, you know, you opening up that door to express, I just wonder with some of the other firemen, if they felt the same way, but just weren't bold enough to speak you know, on it.
Because I think they were just smart enough not to speak. I was too stupid to get the message.
No, I don't agree with you.
There really is. There's a game. There's a way to play it. And I didn't have any of those tools. You know, come in, just people you've never met are throwing shots at you, you know, saying things, derogatory things, whatever. And my response is, you know, let's go. I don't care if you kill me, but I'm not, no, you don't talk to me like that. I don't even know you. So, but I have to follow rules now, and I have to, and my whole future, my children's future is riding on this. So I didn't have the tools. You know, there were other people, they'd throw their shots right back and done in banter. And with me, I'd get angry and I'd just churn, and it's the wrong, once they see that, like an open wound and they just keep digging.
I'm going to be honest with you. You put it in that perspective, I somewhat agree with you. And let me tell you why, because, in any type sport, it's really like a fraternity. What it is. I don't care what sport it is. And for women, of course, a sorority. And there are some things that, yes, it's like an initiation process. Now, when you put it within those contexts, in that context, I said, okay, I see what he's saying now. When he said, well, I wasn't too smart, because this is like the initiation process. And you can't buck back when someone pushes those buttons. I agree with you on that. I've been guilty of it, honestly. Such as yourself, serious. That's why when you said, I said, oh, yeah, well, it's like, hold on, okay. Hold on. Now you've just messed up the relationships you could have had if you had played the game.
I didn't know. I mean, who knew? Nobody ever told me,
But I do still think you tapped into something around the emotional piece. And I do think that, like, especially for men.
Morgan's like, yeah, but you don't understand the agony that caused me. So
no, because if he's talking about this, someone will listen to this that might be in a similar situation.
The audience, yes.
And they may be saying, yeah, I've been feeling this way. And I thought I was crazy because I feel like I'm the only one feeling this. Because no one else.
Play the game though, guys. No, please don't. Just play the game.
I think for me too, I think a core belief that I came to believe really at the deepest core was that I'm worthless and do not have value. So when I've been in situations like that and people tell me that, I believe that a lot more than a compliment. And so this, when it's constant, you didn't do this right. You didn't do that. You suck. You've done it. You can't fight 16 people, 10 people, 12 people, a whole crew. You're going to lose every time. But I think I was predisposed to take all of that and let it kind of destroy my soul, because I don't know. It's a culture. It's not that these people necessarily even feel this way. They know how to play the game. So it took me a few years, but by that point I'd lost the ability to speak. I just shut my mouth.
Though they treated you, and you said this earlier, they treated you like a rookie, to where you felt like a rookie.
I can't lay that on them. That's how I felt. I need to take responsibility for my own stuff, and that's why I'm bringing up the fact of a core belief that made me emotionally unsuccessful. I think as a firefighter and a paramedic, I was good at my job. I mean, I passed all the tests. I always had my quarterly reviews were at least satisfactory, if not excellent. So I think that I didn't have the tools that other people have coming in there. Never occurred to me to be a firefighter. I thought that they, barbecued all day and went to schools and, showed the engine. I didn't know they actually fought fires. I mean, once in a blue moon, running our wheels off. I want to say too, the things that I got to do and be a part of were just incredible, incredible, incredible job and incredible people. I want to make a distinction between the people. It's like anything, a group of people, you have jackasses and you have great people, people that really want to be there, people that really care, people that have empathy.
It's the overall experience that you really, you know, respect and want to pay homage to, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Oh, man, it's like I felt like I'm doing God's work. That's what I felt like. And I had the privilege to do this, to come into people's homes and have their trust and to help them in their hour of need. I mean, for me, there's no higher calling. And to help, to lift other people up. This is kind of going in a direction which I wanted to, which you haven't mentioned yet. Maybe you don't know anything about this, about me. But when I did leave the fire department, I was not in a good way. I was in a pretty bad way. And I really didn't have a plan. I mean, I was going to, you know, do music, but really a 54-year-old guy trying to break into the music industry is... that's not realistic. But it was something I needed to do. And it was just a really heavy, heavy weight on me. It seemed gray. And my sister told me to go meet this guy. She saw what was going on with me. And she said, she called me and said, I want you to go meet this guy tomorrow. Just show up at the address. Don't drink the night before. I said, okay. So long story short, this guy was a ex-Israeli special forces, and he probably killed people with his bare hands and lost friends. I mean, he was in it. And he obviously had a lot of PTSD from that. He met a guy named Alexandre Tenous, who is an ethnomusicologist. He's like a Harvard emeritus professor, and he's been working with sound and frequency. And so this guy that I went to go see, David, was one of his students, and had his life had been changed by this guy. He went through his process, this one day, one evening process of sound meditation. And now he's helping other people. So I went to him and he did this sound meditation with me. It was about 5 or 6 hours. And there's a little more to it, but it was life-changing. The next day, all this weight that I'd been carrying was just gone. These fears that I developed were stupid fear, you know, of like being in the ocean. I've surfed all my life and, you know, I started having fear about even going in the ocean, things like that. Little things don't make sense. Hypervigilance all the time, you know, always just what's going to happen next. And gone the next day, just gone. And 90% of all
sound and I just want to make sure I'm understanding from the sound frequency, like therapy, that's when you started to feel a shift or sound.
I didn't start to feel a shift. I woke up the next day and my life was completely different. I could see the colors, you know, where it was gray before. I had this lightness and these fears, these phobias were gone. I had decided to take my daughter to Kauai, my little 7-year-old. And I said, you know, it's one of my favorite places on earth. I want to share it with her. And I know that I'm terrified to get on that plane and be in a little aluminum tube at 35,000 feet and have no control and no way out. But I just said, you know, I'm going to do it. I'll white knuckle it, whatever it takes. I'm going to do this with my little daughter. I have a little 9-year-old now. So my other kids are grown. And I had scheduled it for the next day. So I picked her up. We got on the plane and I was fine. You know, I mean, you look out and every now you have those thoughts of, well, what if the wing falls off or something? But, you know, the fear that I had, the terror that I had the last time I got on a plane, I was terrorized. Like it was one of the gnarliest 6 hours of my life. And of course, it was the smoothest ride you could possibly have.
Like mental.
I was just waiting for that. I knew the wing was going to fall off. I just knew it. I was just waiting for when, you know. And these are just kind of fears that I developed, and they were gone the next day. So,
let me ask you: do you have your guitar with you?
Yeah, it's right upstairs.
Yeah, I'm going to ask a question. If you were to, to see we know the healing powers of music.
Okay. I'm sitting at a piano, though.
Now, let's do this, okay? I'm going to just sing a short soliloquy, okay? And you can play. We're going to see what type of effect this is going to convey to the audience, okay? Elizabeth is going to be our audience right now, so we'll be able to tell if it's actually shifting her, helping her, based on your playing and, I guess, my poetry reading. You want to try that?
Well, I mean, I'm not... I can play chords, but I'm not
that's
like...
All, that's all we need. That's all we need, a chord, right. Okay? So, let's just do this, all right? I don't care what chord you want to play. I will adapt. I'll adjust, okay?
I'll play a circle.
Okay, go ahead. Obstacles fade, fade away. Now, faith soars on high, without question who believes and serves God. Good job, Morgan.
Yeah, thanks. I couldn't hear, this piano is loud. It was my grandmother's. I couldn't quite hear what you're saying. So how'd it go, Elizabeth?
He did good. He talked about doubt and faith and where the faith lies.
I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, you'll get to hear it when the playback. I think the audience will definitely hear it the first go around and they will enjoy it. He's very creative. So you talked about this ethnomusicologist and sound meditation. So tell us a little bit more about where you are today and how you're using that. Cause I think you use this right in your own life or apply it.
So I took my son and he's an amazing musician and just an amazing guy. And I took him, my mom died and left us a little bit of money. So I used that all for a future, to help myself be whatever I'm going to be in the future. And so this is something that I know is, they won't call it healing, but it healed me and I've seen it heal other people in terms of, if you look at a trauma as a wound, and it heals those wounds. It's one modality. There's another part to it. There's a lot of studies with veterans and PTSD with different types of psychedelics. Ketamine is one that's approved in some states. You can, if you have a license, you can use it. And what ketamine does, especially for these types of dealing with trauma, is the amygdala is your fear center. It modulates your fear. So let's say if you're going through a meditation and this some traumatic event comes up, right? Your amygdala is going to shut it down because it doesn't want you to. You go through the same thing, the same chemicals are released when you relive these traumatic experiences. Your body goes through the same physiological response that you had at the time. So the ketamine does that, but there are a couple other drugs or medicines. MDMA or ecstasy does the same thing. It shuts off the fear thing so that fear can come up, also opens the heart. And then there's psilocybin from magic mushrooms. And I think they're having a huge amount of success with that. Because what that does is it literally rewires your brain. These grooves that get in our brains from experience that we have, they keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper until you change something. But it really works with the neuroplasticity and changes your brain physically and rewires it. So there's a lot of science behind all this. They're doing a lot of studies with it and it's helping people, it's
I thought we were talking about music. I thought we were talking about the healing of music. How did we go from the healing of music to
the thing that I did, this five, six hour meditation, they gave me the MDMA and the psilocybin, little capsules. So it's a lot deeper than just the sound alone. If you're really wanting to deal with deep traumatic stuff that people carry, these supplements in combination with the sound and the frequency.
I'm not trying to be funny, but there have been times when I used to go really hard, you know, whether it was alcohol, you know, and I'm listening to music. Yeah, I felt the sense of peace as well, even if it may have been a false sense of peace. I thought you were equating just your ability, you know, with the sounds, the frequencies, you know, to help provide that. But just listening to you, it's like, yeah, you take a number of these supplements and listen to music. Yeah, it provides that.
Well, let me qualify that. It's not music, it's sound. So it's sound,
whatever,
like let's say you start with the buffalo drum, boom, 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 you know, and you have these vibrations, this frequency going through you, and it kind of riles things up. And then there's a minute or two of silence, and they come in with the Tibetan singing bowls, which emanate frequencies, multi frequencies above and below our ability to hear. But, and then, you know, there'll be silence, and then maybe the chimes, and maybe there's these Indian instruments, these overtonal instruments, the Native American flute, all these. So it's not music, it's sound, it's the frequency. And when you get into the whole science of sound, which is thousands of years old, especially in the Hindu religion, which is what we learned all about in the Eastern music, is a very different thing. They have all these notes in between our notes. You know, we're here and here. They have all these notes in between, but they're frequencies. Every piece of matter has a frequency because its smallest part is photons and neutrons and, you know, these tiny little things that are just beams of light, really. So we have frequency, different parts of our bodies, our organs each have a certain frequency. When that is diseased, like let's say your liver is diseased, then it's got a diseased frequency. It's operating at a lower wavelength. Like they've done studies like grief, sadness, anger. Those are the lowest frequencies that you can live at. And when you say, well, I want to raise my frequency, joy, happiness, gratitude, love, that's those frequencies, which can be measured, are the highest. And the way frequency works is, I think there are three things that can happen. The two frequencies meet, and they either, one will either overcome the other, or they'll resonate with each other, or they'll cancel each other out. So when I play these, if I'm doing it, let's say I was doing it for you, when I'm playing these different instruments, it's emitting all these frequencies that go, and it's like they tune you. They tune your body up. They tune that frequency back up to a healthy frequency. And so it might sound very esoteric and stuff because we never learned any of this, especially in the Western culture. But in the Middle East, in India, in Tibet, and you know, this is ancient knowledge, and now we're just proving it with science. So,
and don't get me wrong. Yeah, when you talk about the frequency and the sounds, yes, I was like, okay, I hear you. Yeah, that I know that to be true also to a certain extent. It's when you started implementing, you know, the aphrodisiacs,
psychedelics,
the mushrooms. I was like, whoa, psychedelic. I'm like, I thought we were just talking about frequencies and sounds.
Yeah, we were, but I mean, I can't. If you really want to heal. I don't know where you'd go to do all that stuff, but all I know is that it healed me, and it wasn't like getting high. That's not what it was about at all. This was a journey. When they say it's an internal journey, I never really understood that, but now I do, because it's, you're going into yourself, into your psyche in a way that you've never even thought of. I went places in there that were terrifying. And then other times I felt a love, like, you know, when people have near death experiences and they feel this love that they describe, it's that kind of love. It's not a kind of love that you can just tap into every day, or maybe that you've ever felt before. It's godly. It's whatever creator you know, ascribe to. It's that creator's love. that just, you can go from a moment of sheer terror, like feel like you're in outer space and complete terror. You can't handle it another moment. And then all of a sudden, these hands just hold you and cradle you. And it's just, it's like a love that is indescribable. So, and also each instrument, when they played, it was like I was an onion, and each instrument pulled a layer off. At one point, I remember my body was shaking uncontrollably, like convulsing, like seizure. But my mind was completely separate from it. And I was able to go, wow, that's crazy what my body's going through right now. And then it was like a Rolodex, and somebody was flipping through a Rolodex really fast, like, and it was faces. And I didn't recognize them. I had no connection to them and anything, but it was faces. And I knew it was dead people. It was all the death leaving my body that I'd seen and been a part of. I mean, I was able to watch that happen sort of in my mind, you know, being a third party to it, watching my body and then seeing that and realizing that this was all that death that I'd been around and experienced leaving my body.
Well, to kind of change gears before we get ready to end the interview, just out of curiosity, who's considered the pillar, the rock of your family? Who's considered that person, that go-to person who could just pretty much just take whatever you bring to them and send you on your way, you know, more encouraged, you know, stronger, better, confident, if there's a person in your family that fits that bill?
Pastor, I'm the last man standing. I think it would be me. Honestly, not to take any kind of credit, but the other, I mean, all of us human beings are damaged, you know, we're not damaged, but you know, we've taken the slings and arrows of life, and some people handle it better than others. And I think that because of my position in the family, I had three much older brothers and then a younger sister, and I got to really look at them. And honestly, one of my brothers is dead. The other one, I'll probably never talk to him again. And I don't know, just I think what we experienced growing up was tough to live through and find success out of. And I think because of my position in the family and just my will, you know, I've accomplished a lot of things. And I have an open mind, and I want to help people and lift people up. And so I think that, you know, my sister's great. We talk and stuff. But I think overall, with all the experiences I've had and the way that I think, I want to be the rock for my family, and I think I am for many of them.
Right, that's fair enough. Most times the people that go through the most, experience the most, and come out on the other side stronger, with a level of more faith and assurance, most times those individuals are considered, you know, the rocks of the family, because they've pretty much seen just about everything. And so they know how to maneuver, and thus they can teach, share, and encourage others, family members, friends alike, how to do the same.
So. Yeah, we appreciate you sharing your journey with us, just all the different things you've had to go through. You know, I'm going back to your mom. She said, why just not quit? Because sometimes, like, you know, we feel so stuck in our head. And then we're like, oh, I can walk away, you know, and not that it's always the easy thing to do, but it just, it's interesting to listen to your journey.
It's a simple concept.
Right, you know? Right. And maybe your mom was more risk averse, because someone who goes to be an actor or actress in general, but I can't say that about you too, because you took some definitely risky paths that, you know, a lot of people might not feel comfortable doing, but maybe she felt that or saw that. And that's why she was able to lead you to that. And she kind of knew you'd be okay, which you are today. So I'm sure she would be proud of, like, the fact that you are working to heal people and take them through a journey of dealing with their inner wounds. Because you're right, those inner wounds will eat you up. If you don't deal with it. And I'm still glad you talked about emotional stuff with the firefighter thing. Mm-hmm. I know there is a brotherhood. I noticed it within fraternities, sororities, there's that whole thing of teasing and going at people.
Because had you not, you would have then kept everything in.
Right.
And you would have been a byproduct of what you were around. Not saying they're bad individuals. I'm just saying you would have became what you were surrounded by, just keeping it, you know, internal.
I did. I was angry. I was bitter. I was, I turned into somebody that I hated, that I didn't like. And I didn't, you know, I couldn't serve the community the way that I wanted to. You know, I had a captain pull me aside one time because I treated this woman. She'd called us a bunch of times, you know, and I always, the key was never where she said it was. The door was always locked. She was always on the floor. But it turned out she was always just hammered drunk. And so after this is like the eighth time I've gone on her, and I knew exactly what was going to happen. I knew we had to break in and there was no key. And I was trying to sort of teach her a lesson, like, look, you know, this is your, it was wrong what I did. And I was not very nice to her. Sorry, but I.
Well, I thought we were going to do another. I was like, oh, are we doing a second round?
But I said, you know, I didn't treat her very well. I was letting her know that this is not okay to, you know, you're going to get drunk. Don't call us every time you get drunk. came out after the call and we got her in the rescue and I was on the truck and Captain came and he's just like, he just ripped me a new one. And he said, you know, I don't care how many times you go on a call, give it your best every time. And I thought, I was so ashamed, you know, I didn't even realize it. And, you know, that factor, that was a big factor too, just that I wasn't in a place anymore where I could really give anything. And, you know, I was angry. I was bitter. I was, it was time to go. So
what would you want people to know that are listening as we wrap up that you're working on right now, or how can they find you if they want to learn more about the things you're doing?
Well, so one thing we haven't touched on at all is I'm really getting into public speaking, keynote speaking now. I just did my first talk in Toronto, my first paid speech. And I felt like it took every experience all of my life. It came together in a synergy in this, from the acting to the, you know, paramedic and firefighter. I just was all there. And what I want to do, I want to speak. I want to take the messages. I want to take the experiences and things that I've learned, the messages that I can learn, that I've learned to help other people, you know, to lift people in another way, to actually affect their souls. Because I feel like as a paramedic, you're putting a Band-Aid on things and you boom, 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 onto the next one, but you're not really changing lives, you know? And the desperation and the hopelessness that I saw, it just makes you cry inside, you know? And I want to take this part of my life to help help myself and other people heal on a deep soul level, you know? And really to bring, there's so much division in our world right now, and we keep dividing ourselves even further, actively dividing ourselves. And it's a scary time. I think that people are so isolated. There's actually, the president just talked about it. They have a whole commission on isolation, loneliness, and the effects on that in the community. So it's a worldwide problem, and it's up to us as human beings to connect with each other. And my talk that I did is about how kindness and acts of kindness can connect us, that we're built physiologically to connect through acts of kindness, whether we witness it, receive it, or give the kindness, our body reacts the same way. We release oxytocin, which is the bonding agent for, you know, kid and mother, for sex, orgasms, all that. It's how we bond as human beings. And then serotonin and dopamine, and they all act on the vagus nerve, which runs through our whole body. It just intertwines with everything. It's not one nerve. It's a web almost, and it's entwined with our most vital organs. So,
well, I totally agree with you. Like when someone does something kind, it's like a domino effect. I've watched it. Someone opens a door, the next person holds the door open. Right. Or next thing happens, but then something not kind is a domino effect to that as well. So I think we are wired to feel those feelings and to be connected to one another. And if you notice, whenever we've had significant tragedies like 9/11, people came really close and were more empathetic, and the world felt a little better. Even though this tragic event happened beforehand, because it brought people closer. So keep doing the work you're doing. What website can they visit you at if they want to book a speaking engagement with you?
Morgan England Music, M-E-N-E-N-G-L-U-N-D is my last name, morganenglandmusic.com. And then all of my social media is Morgan England Music, except LinkedIn. You can find me at Morgan England.
Okay. It was really great to have you on the show. We enjoyed talking to you and learning more about your endeavors. We're going to wrap it up for now. And thank you. We'll be back with another.
Well, we may wrap it up. I don't know if Morgan wants to pull out his football helmet and pads, and, you know, we can get in that 3-point stance. And
We need to talk. We need to talk after this for sure.
All right. So we're going to wrap it up for now. We'll be back with another episode. Please remember to subscribe to the Bed Talks podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other platforms. We're going to take off for now. Until next time, XOXO.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for being on my phone.